even for offline communities or communities where internet's too expensive, they can actually interact with conversational AI and chat with resources that haven't been translated. They're still in English, but they can actually get really quality information through this conversational experience on a single offline laptop.
Welcome everyone to another episode of SlaterPod. Today on the podcast, we welcome Daniel Wilson. So Daniel is the founder and CEO at XRI Global, a language tech research and deployment company. They focus on low resource languages. Hi, Daniel, and thanks so much for joining today.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Florian. Thanks.
So where in the world does this podcast find you? We always ask our guests, what country, what city?
Sure. Yeah, we're just outside of Nashville, Tennessee.
Nashville, Tennessee, the heart of country music. But today's topic, low resource languages, kind of at the other end of the spectrum from country music. So tell us a bit more about your professional background and how you got into language tech.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. My background is academia. So I did a master's and then a PhD in linguistics and just have loved language for many, many years and got into that. That took me actually all the way to Russia, to the Caucasus Mountains, where I was doing research on endangered languages in the Caucasus Mountains. And so I was out there with my microphone and my headset recording dialects that, you know, were, you know, had very little recording or research done on them previously. And that was supporting my research. I was a research fellow at the university that I graduated from and got to work with some very, very impressive colleagues and scholars that were part of several Russian universities. And so the academics was my background. But during that time, I started a consultancy, which was XRI LLC, actually. So we were owned by an NGO. And so I founded this essentially to help provide consulting for those in the nonprofit humanitarian space to explore language technology for some of these long-tail, low-resource languages. What does it actually take to get tools working for these communities, to bring them online, to bring digital equality? And so I did that for about 5 years. And then that took us into doing a lot of data collection, right? Because you can't really build tools for these languages where there is no data. So we developed several apps and learned a lot about data collection and how to do it right, so that we could train models and build systems for these languages. And then sort of the AI boom, you know, that we've all been enjoying happened, and it just looked like an opportunity for, you know, turning this into a legit startup. So we launched XRI Global, and yeah, so now we're all the languages that don't work with AI right now. That's the problem that we're trying to solve.
Before we go into the tech discussion, can we just geek out a little bit on languages and dialects in the Caucasus? I mean, to me, like, it's super complex, right? I mean, I heard Georgian is like super difficult to learn, and there's this eternal rumor that Basque is somehow related to, if anything, to the languages of the Caucasus. Just tell us a bit more about the landscape there.
The Caucasus is a very fascinating space, which is one of the reasons that I was attracted to it. You know, my branch of linguistics, I was doing theoretical linguistics and in a subdiscipline called distributed morphology. And these languages are notoriously just very morphologically rich, right? So it's kind of a real world test of, you know, do our theories about morphology hold up when you throw some of the most complex languages in the world? In fact, some of them, I don't want to perpetuate like a myth that's been debunked, but for a while there, like, we were, you know, there's a couple of languages in the Caucasus that have made it in the Guinness Book of World Records as some of the most morphologically complex in the world. So we've got, you know, and I was working on one of them. And so it was, that's what attracted me to the Caucasus. But you've got between 40 and 80 different languages, depending on what you consider a language versus a dialect, and then 5 different language families, right? So I did live in Georgia as well for a couple of years. Really, really enjoyed my time in Tbilisi. And it's very fascinating, very linguistically complex. The language I was working on, also depending on what you consider a case, but they say it has 64 cases, right? So you've got eight grammatical cases and this incredible grid of spatial cases, right? Where you've got like this matrix of like 7 by 5 spatial cases. And so you can just keep adding at more and more affixes to these words to do lots of really interesting things. And really, the sound systems are incredible. They can do some very, very incredible pharyngealization, very elaborate phonological systems. And then they've got a cool feature in the verbs where you've got this evidentiality, right? Whether or not you've witnessed the action controls you know, what the form of the verb looks like. So if the farmer harvested the wheat and I saw it, I would use a certain form. But if I didn't see it, I would use a different form, right? And so it's just a really there's a lot. I could talk a long time about the complexity and beauty of these languages. So
incredible. I mean, we're proud here having our 4 cases, but 64. That's another dimension. So it's just long. Yeah, it's just very, very long agglutinative words. Is this a function of just the mountainous terrain, or is there some other kind of factor that created this? Because I mean, similar ish here, right? The Alps. I mean, you know, it's like you get a dialect. You basically walk across a mountain, and they speak a totally different dialect on the other side. Are the mountains one of the key factors here, or is it because it's kind of at the intersection of, you know, some of the world's bigger cultures?
That's what some of the research suggests, is it's the topography that has really led to these elaborate spatial case systems, right? Because you need to describe how your friend came up from over around that next hill, right? And so you just, you need to have a way to say that. That's one theory. And also what's interesting, I forgot to say about these, is a lot of these languages they don't come from anywhere, right? Some of them are Indo-Iranian, right? Some of them are Turkic. Some of the language families are only found there, right? And so it's just a really fascinating situation.
Wow. All right, let's head from the peaks and valleys of the Caucasus to XRI Global, the company. So, you know, again, you described it a little bit in the beginning, but give us the company in a nutshell, the elevator pitch, as it were.
Yeah. So when I describe XRI Global, I can do it in two ways. Number one, you know, everyone's excited about AI right now. The promise of AI is that it means everyone's going to get their own doctor. Everyone's going to get their own tutor, right? Finally, we're going to bring all this prosperity to all of humanity through AI. But the reality is there are still 3 billion people whose language doesn't work online. Right, so there's a critical piece of infrastructure that isn't built yet. That's what we're aiming to solve. The other way that I talk about it is, yeah, all the languages that AI is really bad at, that's kind of what we're aiming to solve.
Tell us a bit about the commercialization at this point. So, I mean, maybe you can't share any client names or partner names, but like who are you targeting? Who are kind of, maybe what's the initial client cohort? You know, who do you aim to go after maybe in the next couple of years?
Yeah, well, it became clear. I mean, I've been in this space a long time, and there's a couple of industries that are pretty obvious, and those that working in sort of the humanitarian NGO space, right? These are people that are building very impressive systems for human flourishing, to spread human flourishing to some of the most impoverished places in the world, right? And so humanitarian is a very easy one. We're having some cool conversations and building some cool tools in that space. There's also, you know, now actually a lot, there's LLM companies, right? So they're getting a lot of funding, and data is everything, right? And so more data in more languages is good. But then you've got, you know, other groups like religious communities and governments and some of these others that have interest as well in the kind of work that we're doing.
How do you define what's a low resource language versus like medium resource? Like is there a generally accepted like threshold, or is it?
The definitions are not super consistent. So what I consider a low resource language is like you've got 7,000 or 7,100 languages in the world, right? And you've got maybe like the top 100 maybe that have a decent amount of data and tooling that use that data so that they work with the various systems. So you have, you know, at the highest level, you have these AI assistants, right? But those are built on speech to text, text to speech, machine translation, all these other systems that are built because we have high quality data and we have sufficient data to build these systems as well. And now large language models. And so those would be considered high resource languages that have sufficient data and tooling to enable communication integration in digital spaces. But then you have like medium resource languages, which isn't clearly defined. Like some people consider like Vietnamese and Thai and Turkish to be medium resource. They're not quite at the level of English, Mandarin, French, etc. But they're not super low resource. You can find a decent amount of data on the internet, and you can find tooling that's been built that is somewhat reliable, right? And then you've got low resource languages, which is the large majority of languages where there's hardly any language, there's hardly any data that's online, and that's being utilized in the tooling.
That might be a stupid question, but like if you punch in to like ChatGPT, like I can use it in German if I want to. Most of the time for actual queries, I probably use it in English, but it's very good in German as well. Like, are there languages ChatGPT just wouldn't cover, or would you say, I have no idea what you're asking here, or would it just break and just like give you like a nonsensical answer in certain languages?
Yeah, we've tried to test the limits of some of these larger models on what they know, what's in the training data. It's more or less, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like this is just, you know, I've copied the languages I've worked on in the Caucasus. It just has no idea. It's, you might as well just do a thumb smash because it just doesn't know what it is.
Because with Gemini, I think it actually tells you, hey, this is not yet set up for whatever. I think it recently, even for German, it said it can't do it yet. So interesting. Now, when you go about, how do you select what languages to work on and you offer it? And tell us a bit more about the process of sourcing the data and like what kind of partners you work abroad. I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of people that are out there that help you, not just company full-timers, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's a good question. So in large part, it's determined by the customer. You know, it's if there's a group of farmers, you know, in Kenya, and there's a company has deployed a chatbot, but it only speaks, you know, some of the more well-supported languages, and they want it to speak more languages, they would come to us. And then our process is basically, we kind of go domain specific, right? The when we build a model, it doesn't need to be good at everything in that language, right? Some of these low resource languages will never talk about, you know, advanced chemistry. So we don't need to collect data on that, right? They're very domain specific in what kind of the customer needs. And so what we've done is we've created a system where we can actually collect, we're driven by this question, like what's the fastest and most affordable way to get a working model in a specific domain, right? And so that means we're trying to increase the intelligence per utterance, right? That's our, that's what we're after, is the maximum number of intelligence per utterance that we can extract from data. If there was a perfect data set that we could collect from native speakers, what would it look like? And that's kind of what we've been pursuing. And we're getting really good results, right? So we've got a particular domain, a customer desires for a machine translation system. What we do is we pre-process the source language, the source sentences for that data set that we have determined are optimal for that domain. And then we hire a vendor, right, in a particular region. Sometimes it's an LSP. Other times it's like a local entrepreneur that's trying to build an AI company, and often we're their first source of revenue, and it wasn't quite their idea, but they're there and they're, you know, happy to source that language data for us. So they find the native speakers. We do multiple quality assessment steps to make sure this is the right language and that we can get quality data. And then we hire that local vendor to pay native speakers to use our system. So we have an app that's in iOS, Play Store, and mobile app, web app, and a project management suite where we can push tasks to users, lots of different types of tasks. So translation tasks, audio tasks for building like ASR systems, even some like preference. So we can do something like RLHF or something like that, like preference, is this one better than that one, et cetera. So we have lots of different tasks in the app, and we can upload those, push those to the users, and get the data in quickly that way. So as a data point, you know, we did just a batch of linguists, languages in Indonesia recently, and our best situation was in 4 weeks with a language that had no prior data. We went from zero to actually a 29 blue score, 64.5 CHRF for a machine translation system. So it's a mediocre Google Translate in 4 weeks, sourcing all those sentences from native speakers. And then, of course, we can also fine tune LLMs with those data sets, and have some experimentation we're doing there. And so that gives you an example of, like, we want this to be fast. We want it to be affordable so that we can get these languages online and give them the opportunity to benefit from AI as much as possible.
How do you communicate with some of these people? I mean, Indonesia, maybe not on the main island, right? But I mean, there's some other islands that are quite remote and people live in, like, super remote places. Like, yeah, how do you connect with them? How do you communicate with them?
That's all on our vendor, right? So our vendor guarantees us that they can connect with these people, they can pay these people, and get us the data. We'll never be able to have the relationships that we need to do this unless we depend on local partners. So that's, yeah.
Have you ever spoken maybe to some of the vendor or seen it firsthand? Like, when these people who, you know, are not, I guess, whose usual experience is not like ours. We're like, oh, there's this giant internet, everything's tech, everything's in my language, it's completely a native experience. When all of a sudden they get to experience something like how an LLM can converse with you, for lack of a better term, in their own language. I mean, I would assume that they're, I mean, I'm blown away when he talks to me in German, right? Then what if you've not even experienced, like, you haven't really experienced anything digitally in your native language? Any anecdotes to share?
That's a good question. I was actually in Azerbaijan just a few months ago. We were doing collection on a few languages there. Azerbaijani is more or less supported, right? In ChatGPT. It's not amazing, but it was clear that no one had heard of ChatGPT or AI in the regions that we were in, right? And so often these people will speak multiple, like, many languages, right? And so there was one guy that was, like, really interested. He's entrepreneurial and he really wanted to learn about starting a business, running a business, and how to get ideas, how to test those ideas and everything. And he was very young, probably in his 20s, and just really interested in that. And I opened my phone and, you know, I put the system prompt in there, speak only in Azerbaijani. And I just did the voice, right? I turned on the ChatGPT app on voice. And, oh man, the room just that lit up listening to him interact in Azerbaijani with this AI that's giving him business advice. And then I was like, you know, give him advice from this book or this resource by this author, right? And just the lights going on of, wait a minute, what do I have in my hand here, right? I have a tutor that is here to help me anytime I want with answering these questions about starting a business. And the light bulb just went on for him. I get to do that a lot, and it's really fun.
That is incredible. I mean, we hear about this, like, you know, breaking down the language barriers. It's on your website as well. Like, it's been around forever. But I think now we're starting to hit the point where those barriers are really getting broken down. Like, sometimes, you know, in Europe, we're not really aware of how high those barriers are in other parts of the world. I mean, you know, sure, we Italian, French, everything. But when you're telling me this example, like, you know, somebody's like, wow, now I can actually tap into the world's knowledge, like, in my language, like, boom.
What's interesting is, like, and we did some interviewing and stuff for some videos that we're trying to produce. And I was asking them questions of, like, you know, because it was their L1 that I was talking about. We were doing collection on to help, you know, bring resources and capabilities into the L1, not their L2, which is Azerbaijani. And I was asking them some questions about, you know, where do you see the most positive benefit coming, you know, if your language was useful to you on the internet? And I was just trying to ask really good questions to get from him, you know, does this sound promising to you? And he was an older gentleman. He's like, to be honest with you, and I caught it on camera. He's like, to be honest with you, Daniel, we just need a gas line run to our house. You know, yeah, it would be great if my language worked online, but we really just need a gas line run to the house. Like, there's a lot of other issues that are the highest priority for these communities. And I know that, you know, his son or grandson, right, who is sitting there asking questions about how to start a business to an AI and getting these skill sets, means that he could potentially be the solution to that. He can get the education that he would need in order to bring that kind of infrastructure to that community so they could get a gas line to the house or whatever. So there's like a hierarchy of needs here, right? And we do our best to not bring our solutions to communities that aren't asking for them, where it's very much driven by the community's expressed and felt needs themselves, rather than us saying, we promise this is a good idea and, you know, build it for people who aren't asking for it.
What kind of language is Azerbaijani?
Yeah, it's a Turkic language. It's very close to Turkish. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, I didn't know. What about scripts? Like, I think Armenian has like a really like kind of unique script. Is that an issue in this whole process from time to time? Or?
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, you've got Unicode, right? So a lot of these scripts, you've got Google's Gboard. They've been doing tons of cool stuff with lots of scripts and making most scripts in the world work with Unicode. But we get into the tokenization issue, right, which is causing problems for lots of people when it comes to LLMs and stuff.
Right, because I saw somebody complaining, but it's a while ago, maybe half a year ago on Twitter, I think about an Indic language, and they were also like, hey, this like, it's, there's one token in English, and then it's like 100 tokens if you want to do the same thing in mine, and it blows up my bill.
Exactly.
Tell us a bit more about that. How much of a challenge is that?
Yeah, so like early on, and when I say early on, I mean like maybe 8 months ago, you know, it was this really interesting case where here, those that stand the most to gain from AI have to pay 10 times more than the rest of us to get it to work because, you know, every token, like you said, you know, for English, you've got, you know, two tokens and a word, but in these Indic scripts, you're talking, you know, sometimes 8 to 10 tokens, right? And so it just, the cost of that, right, because of the tokenizers that were built for Indic languages the technology wasn't there. But there are really, really clever and talented native speakers of these Indic languages now that have solved some tokenization issues for some of these scripts. So the space is moving pretty quickly and it's starting to equalize.
Maybe just because this is our audience very much kind of in the language translation industry as well. Like, where does machine translation fit into this, if at all? And tell us a bit more about synthetic data, which maybe can be, you know, generated through MT.
Two good questions. So machine translation for us, at least right now, is it's much easier for us to build a brand new machine translation system that sits as a layer on top of an LLM, right? So one of the cool projects that we're working on right now is we have a customer that's asking for a RAG-based system where you've got a retrieval augmented generation, where you've got a document that's a resource that is, you know, in a particular domain, if it's social services or health or education or something like that. And you've got just this really elegant way of interacting with these documents now through conversational AI and through LLMs. But they need to do it in the language. They don't speak English, right? And so they need to be able to do it. So you can actually put a machine translation layer on top of that to where really you can speak. And we've got it audio enabled where they can speak. It transcribes their audio in the language they're speaking. That gets machine translated. And that does the retrieval augmented generation. It comes back in English. Like, we don't have to translate the resource into English. Like, the resource can stay in English, right? It does the augmented generation of the answer, and that answer is then retranslated with machine translation back into the language that they speak. And actually, the coolest part of this is we've got it working offline now, right? And so what we're able to do is take one of these smaller LLMs and the ASRTTS NMT, we stitch the whole thing together, and it runs on a single laptop with a single GPU, right? And so even for offline communities or communities where internet's too expensive, they can actually interact with, do conversational AI and chat with, you know, resources that haven't been translated. They're still in English, but they can actually get really quality information through this conversational experience on a single offline laptop.
Wow. It was this, I think about a year ago, you, you know, published something around a product, I'm not sure, called Auto Polyglot. Was that, that's related to this?
Yeah. So Auto Polyglot was a fun experiment. It's not anything we're doing anymore. But what it essentially, when I was watching the kind of the LLM space just after the launch of ChatGPT and everything everybody was doing with it, I had a couple of ideas about a way to generate more data that could be useful. So if the problem is data scarcity, we can collect from native speakers, but what if there was a way for us to print unlimited amounts of high quality data to train these systems even better? One idea that I had, because it was really expensive to do, to ask the LLM to do it, was, well, what if we use a rule-based system like a Pertium or something, a rule-based machine translation system? And I tested ChatGPT and some of these other large language models. It actually knows how to write the LexD language, which is under something like a Pertium, right? These rule-based systems. And I'm like, okay, what if I could take a grammar from a language, teach the AI to read that grammar and actually write a Pertium rules and compile the whole thing into a machine translation engine. So we experimented with that, and that was auto polyglot, where go read, you know, this 400-page grammar that some PhD wrote 10 years ago and just write the rules in a way that, you know, would create the rule-based machine translation system. We found I think we've seen the output of rule-based systems, and it's not quite as natural, not quite as human, I think, as what LLMs are capable of.
I remember the days when it was not natural.
Yeah, so we sort of abandoned that, but we kept the idea of what if we could get AI to read these resources, right? Because that is data. It's unstructured data, but it's data, right? It's 400 pages describing every detail about how these languages work. What if I could get it to do that? And so then we did spend quite a bit of time creating an AI agent that did a chain of like 20 different prompts that basically took an English sentence, it parsed that English sentence out as to what all its component parts are, and then it went to the grammar and to a dictionary that we had, and it learned the rules of that language, and it recompiled and wrote that sentence in the low resource language just by reading the book. And we did we got some good success out of that. I think the highest we got was maybe an 18 blue score or 14 blue score or something like that, when we did like, we had to do 200 sentences and just a small amount, and sort of like, and then Gemini 1.5 came out, right? And they did this Calamong experiment. Do you remember that? Where they took a grammar of this language, Calamong, spoken by 200 people, and their performance like just slightly exceeded ours. Like, we had done it months before Gemini came out by doing a very sophisticated, agent setup with multiple prompts going multiple directions. But they just launched Gemini 1.5, uploaded the entire grammar into the context window, and achieved better results. And we're like, okay, maybe this is a compute issue, and it wasn't like if this problem can be solved with compute, that's great. We'll celebrate it. We'll use it. That's okay. But we learned a ton about agentic systems and how to get LLMs to cooperate and guardrails and all that kind of stuff. So it was a fun sort of series of experiments of what if we could create a data printer for any language on earth. And what's interesting is, you know, I came to SlaterCon there in Zurich and been chatting with people in the LSP world and thinking about, you know, where do we fit? We're talking to language technology providers, you know, if you need another machine translation system that is, newly available in these systems, does that sound helpful to you, et cetera? But what was interesting was we went to one conference and somebody was up on stage talking about how terrible LLMs are at Welsh figures of speech, I think. And it doesn't get them right. And he was just going on and on about how LLMs, he said, you'll never get enough examples, representative examples of Welsh figures of speech into the training set for it to actually learn this. And so that was his like big moment of declaring LLMs are not the answer in the future. It went up afterwards because we had just been building this agent, right, to go read grammars and produce sentences. And I asked him the question, I said, have there ever been any books written about Welsh figures of speech? He's like, oh yeah, lots of books written. Okay. All right. Well, then you just tell the agent to go read the book. You just tell the LLM to go read the book, and then you can call it in when you need it, right? Just to kind of let them know, like, it's not just, you know, trying to squeeze more stuff into the training set. that is going to give these things their capabilities. These agentic systems are capable of harnessing unstructured data in incredible ways to solve new problems. So anyway, that's another anecdote for you.
I'm not a Welsh speaker. I think there's so very few, but maybe that problem is solved now, right? But yeah, well, it's interesting to poke holes in the capabilities. Yeah, someone's got to build it, you're right. I'm sure he did. Tell us a bit more about the kind of legal and ethical consideration when you're collecting data. Is there a lot of legal things around, boxes that you need to check, or yeah, just tell us more about that.
We're neck deep in the data compliance, data sovereignty, data transfer, data localization laws, right? So when you're trying to collect data anywhere in the world, it requires a lot of careful attention to local data laws, right? We don't collect what's called sensitive PII, personally identifiable information. We don't collect names, email addresses, phone numbers, social security, any of that kind of stuff. We just give, anonymized user IDs, but that's still considered non-sensitive PII. And there are certain countries that still have laws around non-sensitive PII. And so we just have to pay very close attention to that stuff and make sure that what we're collecting is being treated in the way that it should for that particular region, that particular country. And then, of course, the consent, we have to get all of the consent and all of that. So, yeah, it's an evolving space, right? Because it's on everyone's mind. And so that means regions of the world that haven't previously had much to say in terms of the data laws now are forming coalitions and trying to say, okay, what is our approach here? What do we think, right? Especially because as the news breaks with OpenAI and others that are, in scale.ai, like going out there and collecting data and using people in developing contexts to actually do a lot of their labeling, more and more people are talking about, okay, how can we make sure that this is fair that we're not exploiting people around the world to create AI systems for ourselves.
Yeah, and it's really hard to understand, at least from the outside, what's like a hit piece and what's like actual truth with this scale piece. I wasn't 100% sure. Like it's a little bit of it sounded like a hit piece. But yeah, it's obviously super complex, these things. All right, well, so 2024, we're, one third in. What are some of the plans you can share for this year?
Yeah, so that's great. We are getting more and more demands for more languages, which is real exciting. So we will be building, I would say we will get, I hope to exceed 50 languages this year alone that will have their first machine translation system, as well as AI, LLM capabilities. The other thing that we're really excited about is this tool I was telling you about where you've got an AI on device, can't do it on phones yet, right? It's still, we're not quite there. I have a 7B parameter model on my iPhone, but I have an iPhone 15 Pro, right? And the silicon can handle that kind of stuff. Of course, that's the only thing I can do on the phone if I'm running it there, right? So we're still waiting for like the inference to run on edge devices. And I know that there's a lot of really cool creative energy being poured into that. But for now, we're finding that groups are happy to buy a $1,500 laptop that has a 4060 in it, right? It has a GPU running on it and it unlocks AI in new languages for communities that either don't have internet or they can't afford it. And so I'm really excited about that product of, we can get you an AI on a laptop that works just like you want it to. And you can even customize its knowledge base by sticking in a thumb drive, adding a new document to its mind that you can then, query over, ask questions over and whatnot. So I'm pretty excited about both of those opportunities. New languages with new capabilities.
Not even on-prem, on device. And I mean, I think as Apple is rolling out more AI-geared hardware, right, these things are going to get much more capable to run these models on your device. All right. Well, Daniel, that was fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time today. It was great.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to be here, Florian. Thank you.